everyone. I'm going to provide a little bit of a brief background on the ILO, and then we're going to get into the panel discussion. So for those of you who don't know already, the ILO was founded in 1919 as part of the Treaty of Versailles that ended World War I to pursue a vision based on the premise that universal, lasting peace can be established only if it's based on social justice. The ILO has a unique tripartite structure that gives an equal voice to workers, employers, and governments, today representing 187 member states, to ensure that the views of the social partners are closely reflected in setting labor standards and in shaping policies and programs promoting decent work. The main aims of the ILO are to promote rights at work, encourage decent employment opportunities, enhance social protection, and strengthen dialogue on work-related issues. Setting international labor standards is at the core of the ILO's work. They aim to promote opportunities for women and men to obtain decent work in conditions of freedom, equity, security, and dignity. In the first 2 years of its existence, the ILO adopted 16 international labor conventions and 18 recommendations. The first convention set limits on working hours, established some level of unemployment protection, guaranteed paid maternity leave, limited night work for women and children, and established a minimum age for employment in industries such as manufacturing. Today, I believe there are around 80 conventions and another 80 recommendations. The driving forces for the ILO's creation arose from security, humanitarian, political, and economic considerations. Its founders recognized the importance of social justice in securing peace against the background of the exploitation of workers in the industrializing nations at that time. There was also increasing understanding of the world's economic interdependence and the need for cooperation to obtain similarity of working conditions in countries competing for markets. Indeed, the ILO has played a key role at historical junctures: the Great Depression, decolonization, the creation of Solidarność in Poland, the victory over apartheid in South Africa, and today in the building of an ethical and productive framework for a fair globalization. However, we are well aware that we still face enormous challenges in the regulation of labor in global supply chains, creating good jobs, promoting social dialogue through strong and independent workers and employers' organizations, extending social protection to all working women and men, and obtaining recognition and respect for the rights of workers. In a nutshell, there have been some strides, but the broader goal of achieving universal and lasting peace through social justice has been far from realized in the last century. In this panel discussion today, each participant is going to address the following guiding questions. First, what is living and what is dead in the ILO 100 years on? Second, what lessons can be learned from the past to address the pressing social, economic, and labor justice issues of today and the future? We're lucky to have panelists representing diverse forms of engagement with the ILO over the past many years. Today, they're going to critically examine the ILO and its structure, that is, its standard setting and technical activities, as well as its relationship with states, other international organizations and NGOs, from three distinct yet overlapping angles. This includes perspectives on gender, migration, and international labor regulation by Dr. Leah Bosco, global south considerations of international law and social justice by Dr. Obiora Okafor, and international and national labor policy formulation, instruments, and implementation by Marie Clark Walker. In bios on our panelists, the first up is Dr. Leah Bosco, who is a professor of politics and Tier 1 Canada research chair in the political economy of gender and work at York University. Her research examines employment standards enforcement and access to rights among workers laboring transnationally. She is the author and editor of numerous scholarly books, volumes, and articles. Her latest sole-authored book, Disrupting Deportability, Transnational Workers Organized, was published by Cornell University Press in December 2019, and her latest co-authored book, Closing the Employment Standards Enforcement Gap, Improving Protections for People in Precarious Jobs, is forthcoming this spring with the University of Toronto Press. She asked if I was going to cut her off because she has a lot to say, and I said, no, that is bio, I'm not cutting you off, don't worry. Dr. Obiora Okafor is the York Research Chair in International and Transnational Legal Studies, senior tier, and a tenured full professor of law at the Osgoode Hall Law School of York University, Toronto. He is the UN Independent Expert on Human Rights and International Solidarity, and the former chairperson of the UN Human Rights Council Advisory Committee, the general editor of the international journal, the Transnational Human Rights Review, and editorial board member of a number of other academic journals around the world. He has held the Ghani Fawenimi Distinguished Chair in Human Rights Law, at the Nigerian Institute of Advanced Legal Studies, and served as a visiting professor at a number of universities and institutes around the world. He was conferred the Award of Academic Excellence of the Canadian Association of Law Teachers in 2010, and the Gold Medal for Exceptional Research and Major Contributions to Jurisprudence of the Nigerian Institute of Advanced Legal Studies in 2013. I also will not be cutting you short. Marie Clark Walker is a published author, Vice President Labour of a national political party, and the Secretary Treasurer of the Canadian Labour Congress, and both the first racialized woman and the youngest officer to be elected in CLC history. Marie served as Executive Vice President for 5 terms before being elected Secretary Treasurer in 2017. Alongside her work in Canada, Marie is currently a titular member on the ILO governing body. In 2017, she served as Vice President Workers of their annual conference, and most recently as the Worker Vice Chair. She helped negotiate the historic convention and recommendation on violence and harassment in the world of work. So each panelist is going to address some specific sub-questions as part of those broader questions that I have just posed. They each have about 20 minutes, and at the end I'll try to draw together some themes that emerge from that, but then also open it up to you all to add any of your comments, perspectives, maybe post some questions as well. So without further ado, we'll turn it over to Dr. Boston.
Institution focused on labor and employment issues and as a standard setting body, and forward on what might be. On what might be imagined for the next 100 years in the interest of advancing social justice. So in my talk today, I've been asked to reflect on standard setting activities of the ILO in its first 100 years. That's why I have so much to say about that. Through the lens of gender and migration status. And I've opted to do so through a focus on conventions and recommendations related to the regulation of, surprise, precarious employment. As some in the audience may know, in 2010, I wrote a book called Managing the Margins, Gender, Citizenship, and the International Regulation of Precarious Employment, which pursued case study at different scales, the national, the regional, specifically the European Union, and the international, but took ILO regulations as its point of departure. And so in my remarks today, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this book as and its foremost findings as my entry point and offer some observations about where the organization has come since, and standard setting in particular, has come since Managing the Margins came out, and end by talking about where it might eventually go. So in Managing the Margins, I seek to understand the precarious margins of the labor market. And my starting point is the prevailing view that the full-time permanent job, or what is often called the standard employment relationship, or the FER, is being eclipsed by part-time and temporary employment and self-employment. And to the extent that such a shift is taking place, I ask, what are its implications for the growth of precarious employment and those struggling against it? And in addressing this question, I examine the construction, consolidation, and contraction of the FER, some of those very early instruments to which Kelly referred in her introduction. And I focus on the contested emergence of regulations on so-called non-standard forms of employment within, among, and across different nation states. And I argue that these regulations, I say, are FER-centric,
That is, they see the problem of precarious employment and non-standard employment, and non-standard employment, and this assumption leads to solutions that seek to minimize the deviation from the standard employment relationship. Such regulations conflate non-standard and precarious employment, and thus frame the standard employment relationship itself, or close proximity to it, as the solution to precarious. So this FDR-centric logic, I contend, contributes to the following pattern. The greater the deviation from the full-time permanent job, the lesser the protection such regulations provide. Workers most in need of protection are most likely to be left out, many of whom are women and migrants. And so one of my central aims is to offer some examples of this pattern in the book at the international, the supranational, and the national level. And I do this through case studies of regulatory approaches adopted in Australia, Canada, the EU15, and the United States, and the struggles between and amongst workers, employers, and states that they reflect and engender. And in doing this, I seek to demonstrate that this FDR-centric framework can do little more than manage the precarious margins of the labor market. Another of my central aims is to show, by adopting a feminist political economy approach, that the gendered effects of these frameworks and the citizenship-based and nationality-based exclusions they perpetuate are not incidental. So feminist scholarship on the standard employment relationship has long documented its gendered character, and in particular how this employment model is sustained by norms of female caregiving. Close scrutiny of the roots of international labor regulations make it possible to develop this insight further. For instance, the first successful efforts to forge minimum international labor standards in the 19th century, to which Kelly referred earlier, centered on women and children. Despite women workers' struggles for autonomy in different domains and locales in which they worked, international labor regulations were pursued, however, in the name of protecting the weak. They were also made possible partly by the related assumptions that rights associated with industrial citizenship, specifically the ability to contract freely with one's employer in one's own interest, should be geared to adult men. Only subsequently, when similar standards for labor protection were deemed not to interfere with the freedom of contract, did national governments, trade union federations, and employers' associations accept their extension to adult male citizens. Charting this process, I also discuss the construction and consolidation of the standard employment relationship in international labor regulations in the interwar and post-World War II period. This aspect of the analysis took shape around what I call three central pillars of the standard employment relationship: employee status, standardized working time, and continuous employment. And I also highlight the significance of exclusions in the creation of the standard employment relationship, or the FDR, demonstrating how regulations such as those on hours of work and unemployment relied on and reinforced norms of male breadwinning and female caregiving by, for example, limiting their terms to wage earners in industry. And equally crucial, they maintained exclusions on the basis of national citizenship by exempting special classes of workers, such as migrants. So in response to the crumbling male breadwinner female caregiver contract, regulations in around the 1950s sought to strip the standard employment relation of some of its formal exclusions. And foremost was the Convention on Discrimination in 1958, which ushered in formal equality and included the grounds of not only sex, race, religion, and political opinion and national extraction. At the same time, those based on nationality remained a major exception. That is, the methodologically nationalist premises apparent at the foundation of the ILO continued to frame international labor regulation under the standards. Negotiations towards the convention, I found in the archives when I worked on this, even went so far as to pronounce that the restrictions on employment based on nationality, and here I quote, are expected, non-discriminatory, and a natural outcome of the migration contract, an assumption that largely prevails to date. So quite concretely, The ILO retains conventions on migration that take a tiered approach to providing for protection, one that's reflected in the UN Convention on the Rights of Migrant Workers and Their Families. And under this approach, citizens and nationals have the fullest set of formal labor rights followed by permanent residence. Then come migrant workers, whose rights also vary on the basis of stream and nature of migration. And this tiered approach prevails even in the face of a new global compact on migration of 2018. Negotiations over this particular non-binding most recent compact attempted to transcend some of these divisions by minimizing exclusion between legalized and undocumented migrants. Yet, despite such proposals, for example, for establishing a firewall between service providers and immigration enforcement agencies, provisions that were ultimately adopted there, even in this non-binding instrument, ultimately watered down these aims. Against this backdrop, in managing the margins, I develop a portrait of contemporary trends illustrating the slow decline of the standard employment relationship in the neoliberal era in a range of industrialized contexts where it reached ascendancy. In doing so, I illustrate further that full-time permanent employment and non-standard employment remain gendered and shaped by citizenship status and, of course, due so to the present. So with this framing, what I do in managing the margins is I examine a series of post-1990 international regulations that are directed at non-standard employment in response to the growth of precariousness. And I do this, as I said earlier, using illustrations at different scales. International labor regulations developed to respond to precarious employment in that period and moving forward, I suggest, focus on bringing those forms of employment falling just outside, I say with emphasis, the standard employment relationship into its range. They address divergence from this model on the basis of, for example, working time, continuity, and employment status. They'll just do this from place of work and homework, but I don't have enough time to talk about that here. I can talk about it maybe in the question. So with regard to deviation on the basis of time, for example, I analyze the logic of the ILO Convention on part-time work through an illustration of the regulation of part-time employment in Australia, where this form of employment is deeply gendered and racialized, and much of it is casual and thereby highly precarious. In the case of deviation on the basis of continuity, I look to both the EU directives on fixed-term and temporary agency work against the backdrop of an ILO convention on temporary agency work. And here I focus on two types of temporary employment in the EU, fixed-term and temporary agency work, illustrating that the latter is highly precarious, that is temporary agency work, and involves a disproportionate number of migrant workers. Finally, regarding status, I look at the ILO recommendation on the employment relationship vis-a-vis the emergence of self-employment, solo self-employment in OECD countries defined by high levels of insecurity and common among both women and migrants. So together, the cases I analyze demonstrate that approaches to regulation that take the SER, the standard employment relationship, as a baseline, mainly extend labor protection to forms of employment falling just beyond its range. Those gendered and citizenship-coded situations, employment situations deviating sharply from the standard employment relationship are least likely to be improved. And in response to this finding, by way of conclusion, I assess a couple of alternatives to what I call SER centrism. I look at a beyond employment model in Europe, that's advanced in Europe, and I suggest that it's interesting in terms of delinking non-standard and precarious employment, particularly along gender lines, because it seeks to offer social drawing rights or the ability to withdraw from or alter labor force participation to fulfill responsibilities in the public interest and therefore addresses caregiving to a degree. However, I suggest that even this model fails to address, and others as well, the methodologically nationalist premises upon which laws and policies at the supranational, national, and regional level are based. So I suggest that we need an alternative imaginary towards the development of global labor market membership that adaptively moving towards understandings of global universal caregiving and away from state-centered, nation-state-centered notions of membership. So since I wrote Managing the Margins, the most promising development, and I'm not going to talk here about the recent convention on harassment that maybe Marie will talk about, because I feel like stealing on thunder. It's very impressive and important. But in the domain of regulation around precarious employment, consider managing the margin, one of the most promising developments, in my view, has related to addressing the gender and migration citizenship coded character of precarious employment has been the development and passage of the new ILO Convention on Domestic Workers. I haven't written a study on this instrument, although I've supported a lot of workers' organizations in Canada and internationally in lobbying for it. And my dear colleague, Professor Adele Blackett from the Yale, who's going to speak at York in this series on March 20th, has written a book on the subject titled Everyday Transgressions that looks behind the scenes of the adoption of this instrument. But broadly, I want to say that the push for an ILO standard on domestic work emanated from the need, also I'll talk about it briefly, from the need for the protection for domestic workers that it would address two dynamics in particular that were not addressed sufficiently in these previous instruments. On the one hand, the need to address the long-standing tendency, and this tendency is evident in by showing managing the margin in instruments on leisure time, on the household, the sacrosanct, inhibited intervention, the long-standing tendency to treat the household as a site outside the labor force, that is, as a private domain or a sphere properly outside the arena of labor regulation and certainly of labor inspection. On the other hand, the Decent Work for Domestic Workers Convention arose from a fundamental need to address the transnational character of this work, much of which increasingly involves migrant workers, whose worker activism, scholars like my good colleague Ethel Turgohan, shows partly motivate its emergence. In the face of these dynamics, once the decision to move forward with negotiating a standard on domestic work was made or had been made, its drafters were tasked with establishing that there is no fundamental distinction between work in the home and work beyond it, and updating long-standing definitions of the workplace, and thereby of employers, to recognize the home as a potential, and indeed transnational, workplace, and working people as potential employers and recruiters of migrant domestic workers. Interesting, however, as Blackett astutely observes, fundamental to developing this standard was a recognition that domestic work, and here I quote Adele, both work like any other and work like no other, a point she makes to underline the continued link between servitude and subordination, or to cite her once again, the uneasy coexistence between status and contract in this domain, referring to the fraught intimacy in domestic work wherein the employer's recognition works to erase the worker's subjectivity while at the same time placing her in a position of servitude. Also fundamental in developing this latest standard around precarious employment was a recognition among its drafters, albeit a little bit less explicit, I think, and unfortunately so, that processes of racialization and indeed racism shape the law of the household workplace. So that the fact that racialized invisibility coexists with and ascribes a filter through past and past. So to address the link between servitude and subordination under the convention with regard to social security, for example, domestic workers under its auspices are to, quote, enjoy conditions that are not less favorable than those applicable to workers generally in respect of social security protection. Yet, due regard for the special character of domestic work is to be taken, such that its specificity is recognized while substantively equal conditions are ensured. And in my view, this is a real victory. It's one of these novel ways that the convention, it's in this very novel way that the convention is promising. For example, it asserts that providing protections for domestic workers means balancing households' rights to privacy with a government's responsibility to enforce labor legislation. Representing a key achievement in the arena of working time, it also declares this instrument all periods when domestic workers, and here I quote the convention, remain at the disposal of the household, even when they're not engaged in assigned tasks, but when domestic workers are engaged in assigned tasks. but on call, nevertheless, as working time. And quite significantly, the convention encourages ratifying states to adopt measures that enable domestic workers to reside outside of their employer's household, and for those who live in their employer's households to be entitled to maintain all their travel and identity documents, which is, again, important given the significance of employer seizure of such documents. And so such provisions are weaker, maybe, than advocates would have liked, but are nevertheless, I think, really quite important symbolically. And so too are provisions that ban direct fee charging, something I studied at around looking at early 20th century, on the part of recruiters who, in the Canadian case, operated across borders and took advantage of many migrant domestic workers to Canada in that period. And more notably, even more notably in my view, is the challenge that the convention attempts to make to methodological nationalism, in contrast to other international conventions on migrant work. Here specifically, the silence or the omissions are just as important as the noises in the convention, in my view. So that is, it neither suggests that states might create separate rights on the basis of individual domestic workers' migration status. In fact, it shies away from suggesting that this is possible. And in this way, the standard open space for social movement actors and workers' groups to claim the terrain of equal protection at the domestic level in countries like ours, where that terrain has not at all been equalized. For example, not so long ago, that there was a 2-year live-in requirement under the Canadian program. At the same time, despite such important openings, visible in its silences, like other international labor standards, the convention upholds national sovereignty and gives deference to national and regional laws and policy reforms, yet still, given the power of moral suasion and hopefully the rising tide of domestic worker activism, it is significant that the new convention has already been ratified by 29 countries. While many such countries are sending states of migrant domestic workers, several are also host states, including Sweden, Finland, Germany, Italy, Belgium, Ireland, and Switzerland. Aside from the adoption of the Decent Work for Domestic Workers Convention, I would say that there are also some incremental movements afoot to help improve the rights of migrant workers. For now, these efforts are occurring principally at the level of either technical assistance or constituent agreements to have research undertaken on vital topics such as the nature and effects of temporary labor migration and patterns in its growth globally. For example, about a year ago, at the instigation of trade union representatives like Marie, the governing body of the ILO agreed to have research undertaken around temporary labor migration, of which several of us are a part. And it's not clear what such investigations will do or will lead to. But it's my hope that they'll inform the creation of a new standard on migrant work that has a better suite of protections, because obviously one is definitely needed. So optimally, were there to be a new standard, it would attend, in my view, to both the subordination and servitude that Adele Blackett talked about, characterizing forms of work undertaken transnationally, like domestic work, but also other forms of migrant work, and transcend the FDR-centric logic of regulations that legitimize the marginalization of people based on gendered and racialized processes, as well as on account of citizenship status. That is, under a best-case scenario, a new standard around labor migration would adopt an alternative imaginary towards the development of global labor market membership, that is, towards freeing certain labor protections from the exclusive domain of nation-states and in particular post-nation-states. Still, I don't see the passage of international labor standards in any way as a panacea. In fact, I spent the last 10 years since I wrote Managing the Margin Study Enforcement. So, and deportability and questions that are like far beyond these standards. At best, as a mobilization that took place around, especially those on homework, which I didn't really talk about too much, and domestic work suggests, they can be tools for changing practices at the local, national, regional, and ideally transnational levels. For example, the Convention on Domestic Work served to bolster advocates' arguments for eliminating the live-in requirement in Canada's former live-in caregiver program and home caregiver program, and ultimately called for direct pathways to permanency, which hopefully we are seeing emerge. This is where I would go in the future. What is crucial is using the best elements of these standards, often contained in recommendations, and especially radical elements of the debates through which they have taken place, to actively challenge dominant, yet outmoded ideas about proper spheres and proper subjects of labor regulation, about the national boundaries of labor regulation, and about how best to diffuse these norms without reproducing highly problematic assumptions that somehow ideas flow from the global north to the global south, from the center to the periphery, and from international institutions like the ILO outward, rather than through social activism. Thanks so much.
Can you turn it over?
Thank you so much. I'm afraid my presentation is going to be disappointing, just following right after our own, and it's even more problematic because I'm not a labor law expert or a labor studies expert, so I'm an imposter. I think perhaps no one will know how she read it wasn't published. And seeing the one thing I've written about the ILO of my life, which was just published in December 2019, which is that's why I don't know how I got invited. The ILO's 100 years anniversary, but they asked me to think about the relationship between third-world approaches to international law, which is a quote-unquote school of international legal studies. Which likes to think of itself as a social justice movement, which is not usual with intellectual sort of academic groups, right? And the ILO social justice movement, right? So I then prepared a paper about it, which answers the questions that one posed. And now I'm going to just kind of skip to the paper in the short time that I have. I'm not going to talk about everything there, otherwise we'll be here till tomorrow. So essentially what I'm going to do is to, after some preliminary remarks around, what exactly does the 12 do and what does the ILO do in my understanding, how are they social justice, how do they pursue the purpose of social justice in different ways? I'm going to look at more focused way on the similarities and differences, and then on what I think they can learn from it, in a sense, right? And so that way, I come around to answering the second question that you posed to me. So what is the third world approach to international law, which we call TWIL, for short? What is TWIL? TWIL is an intellectual movement within international law. It's been variously described as a network, an approach, a method, a theory. I don't really care, right? My view of it is that it is a way of doing, quote unquote, international law, because for me it's a form of doing as well. It is a practice that seeks to do two things. First, to uncover the ways in which international law either systematically or otherwise disadvantages peoples that you could use the moniker third world to describe. I'll come to that. I will get into the huge debate about whether there is in fact a third world, if there is, where is it located, does it have a geographical? I'm not going to get into that, because that alone will occupy us for the whole day. But I'll just say one thing about it. And secondly, for some 12 scholars, not our post-structuralist 12 scholars, some 12 scholars also attempt to envision what a just international law might look like from the point of view of reform law. Now, just to say very quickly that courts clearly, from what I've said, Tulu does not present itself as floating high above politics, as many international, sorry, many intellectual schools do, not always with credibility, in our view, as sort of beyond politics, right? Small p politics. We don't attempt to do that. It is an avowedly political movement in that sense, meaning that people have a political commitment to do that kind of work. Not necessarily that the work is, you know, political, but the political commitment to do that kind of work. In terms of where the Tokyo is located, I'm going to say one line about what my former professor, how she sees it, kind of middle style, UBC. Twill is a chorus of voices, right? They're all different. They're altos, sopranos. They're not the same, obviously. China is not Zimbabwe or something. Nigeria is not India. But China still votes in the G77 to this day. I was in Argentina at the South South Conference recently, and it's every single thing G77 was China, right? And which is intriguing, right? But we could get, I'm very interested in that question, but I'm not going to concentrate on it today. However, Twill is actually more to a fixed geographical space. So the conception of global people is a bit flexible. It has grown to accommodate even what's referred to as the north within, sorry, the south within the north. And we recognize there's also a north within the south, you know, if you know what I mean. For example, P.S. Chimney talks about a transnational capitalist class, right, that not floats above these categories, but sort of transcends them to an extent. But having said that, many of us still believe that there are still geographies of injustice, and here I quote Brendan Bakshi's work, there are still geographies of injustice, right? So, a First Nations reserve is a geography of injustice, right? There's no way to sort of escape that, right? There are particular geographies that experience these injustices in a much harsher form than others. So, with that, I will not say what we can in conversation talk more about. Well, if you like, but I don't think that's why we're gathered, but I just wanted to give you a flavor of that before I get into the main subject of the day. Now, in terms of the ILO, why do I see it? At least, why do the ILO itself see itself as doing social justice? It's in the Constitution, of course, of the ILO, and since then, in a number of instruments. The ILO, of course, started with setting, you've heard from here, and others, setting standards around workers' rights, around labor rights. But the ILO does more than that, right? So, even just 10 years after its establishment, it explicitly took a turn toward a broader view of social and economic rights. So dealing with the social and economic rights more broadly in order to deal with the problems that workers face, right? So not just necessarily, you know, their work hours and so on, but social and economic rights more broadly. I'm not going to get into what social justice is. That's another rabbit hole that will keep us just to say that I kind of like Thomas Fugger's institutional justice approach, institutional approach to social justice, where you don't look at just agency, but there's a structural dimension to it as well. So you look at structures that produce injustice, right? I know this is all superficial, but we can we can get into it if you like. I don't have time, unfortunately, to get into detail. Like I said, how we conceive social justice is the way in which ILO conceives it, and I conceive it. The ILO does more than just setting standards for labor workers' rights. It looks at social and economic rights of workers more broadly. It has dealt with the rights of indigenous people, actually, much very broadly. I think it's the only binding global instrument. It has produced the only one on the rights of indigenous people, legally binding. They have lost sense to this date. It has dealt with slavery, of course, which is related, child welfare, inadequate housing, social security, and so on. And they're all related, but not simply just setting the work week and that kind of a thing in a narrow sense. So that's the basis to my claim that ILO does, or at least keeps claim, which I agree with to an extent, that they do to social justice. Now, this is not to say that the ILO social justice work has been unproblematic, right? I think Pierre has discussed some of it, but for example, even the first convention on the rights of indigenous peoples of 107 was very problematic. It was assimilationist, it was paternalistic, it allowed governments to seize native lands for its projects, and so on and so on, which of course was impetus for its modification to Convention 169, right, which is the operating one at the moment. So 169 trying to get away from that assimilationist, paternalistic approach, also stops calling indigenous people's populations, started calling them people, which is it's very important, symbolically at least, and so on. Okay, so in a very sort of quick way, I've sort of said, what Twill does, what the ILO does, but what's similar and what is different, right, about what they do. I think the similarities are rather obvious, at least to me. The first is, of course, that they're both concerned with the production of international law, right? The ILO produces international law. It's international law about particular things, so workers' rights, but also indigenous rights, for instance, but also social security law and so on. They're concerned with it in different ways. The ILO produces it to a critics, right? But it is a similar focus in that sense. The second, is that they're also concerned with workers' rights. At least some close scholars, including myself, I'm actually the son of a labor activist. Just because I don't do labor rights doesn't mean I'm not in favor. Twill, and he was a lawyer, things like that. Scholars, many, not all, do focus on workers' rights, or at least on rights that benefit workers, right? As I know, obviously does. The third similarity is that they both are particularly concerned with economic and social rights. The reason is that economic and social rights have traditionally been de-emphasized by national law and even international human rights law. Obviously, to this day, for example, the U.S. still votes against economic and social rights and human rights council when it doesn't have to pull out of it. So economic and social rights have been the concern of anyone, whether the ILO, Twill scholars who want to do social justice. The last one that I'll talk about is that both of them now, at least now, focus indigenous, the rights of indigenous peoples. The focus of 12 on indigenous peoples has been more recent, obviously, than that of 12. It's a very long-standing Convention 107, it's a very old treaty. And some of the 12 focus on indigenous people is actually due to Amar's work. He's sitting right here. That's what he does, actually. So these are similarities. I mean, you see that both of them do social justice work in that sense, in terms of, for 12, trying to critique international law for its contribution, shall I say, to the miseration of dispossession, of disadvantaging of these peoples, of fellow peoples, of indigenous peoples, and so on. The ILO, in a sense, trying to redress that, right? But in terms of differences, the first difference is that the engagement with rights of indigenous people has been much more central to the ILO's work than 12's work. It's the more recent, shall I say. But the converse is that, at least from the 12 point of view, the ILO's work has not focused as much as we think it should on the structure, right? It tends to focus on what we see as the symptoms of the structural condition, right? It doesn't focus on the structures that produce those problems. So it focuses on all the problems you see, but doesn't tend to focus as much. Well, squarely focuses on the structures that produce it. In other words, close scholars do not, for example, accept that the miseration of third world people is entirely because of the choices of their political leaders. That is the normal conventional wisdom. Part of my work is actually to debunk that. I've just coming from reading one of my doctoral students' PhD thesis, and you're doing this in the development field, right? So basically showing how the framework governance of your average global state doesn't reside there. No, it does have, you know, so macro doesn't reside there, but it does have space in the micro to do X or Y, but within this new liberal container. And it's been like that for a long time. It's not just with the advent of neoliberalism. So these are structural concerns, right, in terms of the structure of the globe, in terms of the structure of the global political economy, and so on. How money flows, for example, how resources flow, what is the direction of flow at the end of the day, right? All things considered, there's a net outflow of resources, massive net outflow of resources from the third world, and those cannot but it will factor in corruption and so on. I often joke that you can have a decent conversation about any government without corruption, right? So I have to throw that in. Factor in corruption and everything. If you want to have socio-economic rights, health rights, and all that, you have to have some resources. Possibly, if you want to have fair trials, you need to have resources. If you want to have democracy, you need to have resources. I don't actually agree that economic and social rights are doing the rights that require resources in order to realize fully, right? And all that. But what we're saying is that the structure of the global political economy contributes. The exact extent of that contribution will depend on the exact situation we're looking at, but it does contribute. And I think this has been shown in all kinds, you know, by so many people of color in all kinds of sectors, from investment to human rights to development and so on, to the dispossession disadvantage that is felt by even workers in many of these countries. Social justice discuss its practices is much more structural than the ILO, and I think this is something the ILO perhaps can learn from Twill. children. Another thing perhaps related to this is that 12, for example, the ILO in human rights work does not tend to focus on perhaps the most radical revision of human rights. For example, as we speak in Geneva, negotiations are ongoing around the banning treaty on the right of development. That is massive, right? It's shaping it back. But the day that decision was taken, the EU rights worked out. That was then, they don't work out. They're usually genteel diplomats. They worked out. So that is shaking up the international system. The idea of a right to development, which doesn't attract much debate when I teach in Nigeria. Actually, it's not even controversial, right? But it's very controversial on the global scale, right? And there is a coalition that is pushing it through. I helped to peer review the UN Language Zero draft, which is the first kind of draft that will be negotiated. And it's going to introduce important disciplines, for example, for transnational corporations, corporations that wasn't there before, which matter. I don't know if people read about African affairs, but the Tanzanian government, for example, just by fencing their diamond and gold mines, has increased revenue by about something like $1 billion. The diamond and gold was simply being stolen by the very companies, including Canadian companies, of course, which are the most important miners in the world, that are mining them. And under-reporting to the tune of 50-60% what they are stealing. This has been happening for 100 years. So you can imagine, simply by fencing it and saying everything goes through one gate. You know, this is what he has recovered. So this is what I'm trying to do. So the right development discuss matters. It's not totally unproblematic, but it matters to think about that. It's not simply about what those governments are doing that's led to their condition or the condition of people there. There is a global context to it. Lastly, the ILO, I will admit, has been better than 12, even though 12 I think has caught up. In terms of thinking of the quote unquote the third world state, there's no such thing that exists, but just for discussion, the third world state as a, the ILO tends to think of it as a state that is subject to class divisions and variegation and all that, the wrong economic lines. Early 12 scholarship tended to talk about fellow peoples in a more monolithic sense, as if there were no gender divisions or class divisions or divisions around indigenous peoples and ethnics and all that, right? Poor, rich, and things. So people like Chindi about 15, 20 years ago started to write about this, that we shouldn't be taking the third world state as a sovereign class entity, right? And that this is important. So when we talk about third world peoples, even international scholarship needs to focus on the ways in which that the remuneration is produced globally is also received differently along gender, class, and other lines within these countries. So with that, I think I'll leave it at there and say thank you so much for inviting Alan Postman. Thank you.
Definitely not an impostor. Oh, the room has shrunk. Good afternoon, everyone. So, I'm probably going to jump all over the place because as people were speaking, I was thinking of things that I could say to either give examples of what you were talking about or push back just a little bit. So, as the International Labour Organization marks its 100th anniversary, there was a collective reflection on its impact as a multilateral standard-setting organization. A number of us got together and started discussing what has it done for us in 100 years. And so I think it's fair to say that virtually every labor law in every country has originated at the International Labor Organization since its creation. starting with Convention 001, which was on hours of work, to last year's historic adoption of Convention 190 on violence and harassment in the world of work. So there are 190 conventions and 206 recommendations. So what happens, and I like to talk a little bit about what the ILO does, because there is always this assumption that people know, and a lot of the times people have no idea. When I started as a member of the governing body, I thought I knew a little bit about what they did, and it turns out I really didn't know as much as I thought I knew. It takes a long time to understand all the intricacies of the organization. So I am literally a baby in terms of stages, right? So once the nation ratifies the convention, it also has to ensure that it comes in compliance in their law and practice with obligations of the standard that they've adopted. The supervisory mechanisms that are there at the ILO then are there in place to monitor and respond to the cases of violations of these obligations. The ILO was definitely founded, and people have already talked about it, on broad aspirational principles that social dialogue and social justice are the basis and for peace and stability. And representatives that are at the ILO come from different places with different ideologies, different experiences, and we all bring that to our work, and that's even within the workers' group. Declarations issued by the ILO have reaffirmed those principles and advanced discussion on labor rights within the context of the prevailing labor landscape and growing challenges posed by the globalization of the economy. So declarations like the 1944 Declaration of Philadelphia, which stated that labor is not a commodity, that declaration is still very, very relevant. And I think that, I mean, there was this whole talk at the 100th anniversary as to whether or not they wanted to rewrite the declaration. And a number of us pushed and said, well, we believe that the 1944 Declaration is still very relevant, and that's probably what we should take forward for the 100th anniversary. And there was a lot of pushback on that. And as you can imagine, the pushback came from employers who wanted to change the language. They felt that the declaration was much too strong and gave more to workers, which is what the organization was supposed to do because of the power imbalance between employers and workers. But again, these are the types of discussions and arguments we're having at the organization now, 100 years later. The 1988 Declaration on Fundamental Principles and Rights at Work, which is also an expression of commitments by government, employers, and workers' organizations to uphold basic human values and basic human rights, that is also being pushed back. The 2008 Declaration of Fair Globalization, which aimed to provide a contemporary vision of the ILO's mandate in the era of globalization, and the Tripartite Declaration of Principles Concerning Multinational Enterprises and Social Policy, which was adopted in 1977 and updated in 2017. And that particular declaration recognizes the need to encourage the positive contributions of the MNEs and minimize or resolve the difficulties to which their various operations give rise. For anyone who was there in 2017, there was a lot of debate, a lot of discussion, a lot of pushback. So a lot of the progressive language that we were able to, well, not me, because I was definitely wasn't there in 1977, but people were able to get in 1977 was actually erased and pushed back on. So the Centenary Declaration for the Future of Work, which was adopted last year on the 100th anniversary, represents an important renewal of the social contract between government, employers, and workers, especially in the face of this new business model that are coming forth. Also the increasing erosion of workers' rights, persistent poverty, inequality, and the conflicts in many parts of the world. By the way, all of those things were things that employers did not want to talk about. How can you talk about, you know, the future of work when you're not looking at what's happening right now? The declaration represents an important renewal for the commitment to realize social justice and universal and lasting peace through decent work. It also calls for just transition measures to protect and support livelihoods in the transition to a carbon-free economy and in the accelerating digital transformation of work. Collective bargaining, dialogue between unions, employers, and governments, and cross-border actions to secure workers' rights and supply chains were also given high prominence. Labor migration, all of those things. It confirms the historic tripartite and normative mandate of the ILO as still fully relevant for the 21st century. And when I say that, again, that was a struggle. So while the document, the declaration, actually does confirm all of this, it was still difficult to even get a recognition that this is the way that the ILO needs to continue to operate. It also addresses the erosion of employment relationship and the need for protection of all workers, covering old and new forms of work, including non-standard forms of work, as well as platform work, in order to ensure that the ILO standards remain as inclusive as they were meant to be. The declaration has clear messages on providing all workers with adequate protection in line with the decent work agenda, and the elements that at least need to be addressed: fundamental rights, adequate minimum wage, maximum working hours, and health and safety at work. Does all of this while reaffirming the importance of the employment relationship and promoting transition from the informal to the formal economy. Importantly, it also reaffirms the need for universal access to social protection and sets the foundation to provide safe and healthy working conditions, the status of a fundamental labor right. It gives urgent priority to the development and the implementation of a transformative agenda for gender equality at work. It promotes quality public services and the employment opportunities of the public sector, so important for sustainable, inclusive, and gender-equal economies and societies. The declaration also calls for macroeconomic policies, trade, industrial, and sectoral policies that promote decent work. And all of that said, I still believe that the declaration wasn't strong enough. There were a number of us that really pushed back, but in the spirit of consensus, because the ILO is a consensus organization, these were the things that were agreed on. And I'm going to just digress from my notes for a second, because I think it's important that folks know that there was an attempt to do a give and take when the declaration was being negotiated. So there were those who said, well, if we don't put so-and-so or X in Convention 190, will you agree to this in the declaration? And so we believe, some of us would say we know, we believe that there was an attempt to weaken Convention 190 at the expense of, or strengthen the declaration at the expense of Convention 190. As the negotiator, the worker negotiator of 190, my answer to that was, hell no. We're not backing down. We're not getting rid of any of the language that we have. We're going to continue to negotiate forcefully, and whatever we get, at the end of the day, we get. Interestingly to note, too, that there were those in the workers' group that felt that we were not going to get everything that we were asking for, and or demanding in some instances, and we needed to sort of take a step back. And again, you'll see when I talk a little bit about 190, not only did we get every single thing we asked for, but we got more. It's an excellent, excellent document, which I will share a little bit later. The unique characteristic of the ILO, of course, is its tripartite structure. It's the only UN agency that has that tripartite structure. It's also, to note, the only UN agency that is unionized. Workers and employers have an equal voice with government, and it's the only UN and multilateral agency that functions in this way. The Canadian Labour Congress has been the most represented labour organization and member of the ILO. The CLC sits on the governing body of the ILO and leads an annual delegation to the International Labour Conference, participating in the Committee on the Application of Standards and ensuring that Canadian worker representatives are robust participants in each of the annual discussions. We meet for 2 weeks, twice a year, and then again 2 weeks during the conference. And at those meetings, we advance policy, administrative, and supervisory issues. For the last 2 years, I've led the workers in the standard-setting discussions that led to the adoption of Convention 190, Violence and Harassment in the World of Work. I think what is important to talk about with respect to Convention 190 is the nature in which it was negotiated. We made sure that every worker had a chance to speak to what was happening in their reality, in their country, and make suggestions for language. But there was something different. As I said, I'm a baby at the ILO, so whatever has been done in the past, I had no idea what was done, so I did it the way that I thought it would work. Although there were those who had been there for decades that were saying, no, you have to do it this way, and I pushed back and said, no, I'm going to do it my way. And so we did. And one of the ways that worked, and I think will continue to work, is the way in which we dealt with government. So, as you can see, I've shoved my notes completely. One of the things that you quickly realize is governments come to a decision in their government groups, right? There is the Gulf States, there's the Africa group, there is IMEC, which includes some of the European countries, Canada, the U.S. when they want to include themselves. There's Asia Pacific or ASPAC. There is GRULAC, which is Latin America and the Caribbean and South America. So there are all of these groups. One of the things that we did differently this time was we sat down with the government groups because we wanted to hear what their concerns were and we wanted to tell them what it is we wanted in this convention and why. It's interesting that the groups that really understood were the groups that are typically marginalized at the ILO. And so the Africa group immediately took a position that supported the workers immediately. And there was backlash on that from other government groups who felt that, to quote them, the workers were in bed with the Africa group. But it wasn't the fact that we were in bed with the Africa group. We were listening to what they were saying. Because one of the things that we wanted to happen for this convention was we wanted it to be ratified. And in order for it to be ratified, we had to make sure that there was language in the document that was ratifiable. And so listening to what governments could, couldn't do, helped us to formulate that language. We also were very clear we did not want a convention that was weak. We wanted one that was innovative and strong, but ratifiable. And I think we got all of that in this particular convention. And again, from what was said when we were getting ready to adopt it from government, it was because we took the time to listen. The other unique thing that I had no idea about was government groups at the ILO meet in their government groups. So the only time they come together as a complete government block is when we're actually in the governing body room. So if that's happening, there's no way for one group of countries to hear what the other group of countries are saying, what their discussions were, and what their issues are, and how they resolve. Because they're never in that same room together to be able to have that discussion. Workers group, we do that. We have everybody in a room twice a day discussing line by line by line a document. And so when we found out that this was the case, one of the things that that we did was encourage the government groups to actually talk to each other. We don't know whether or not that happened in the first year. I actually think it didn't happen in the first year, but it eventually happened. And I'll talk a little bit about the fact that what happens in these negotiations and these committees is it spills out into everything else that governments do. And so if a government or a country or a group of countries don't feel respected, then it creates a different kind of dynamic inside the governing body. Because if they feel that what they're saying and what they're putting forward is not being listened to, is not being respected, is not being taken into consideration, eventually they're going to either stop or they're going to walk out. And that's what happened with this negotiation. The African group walked out over LGBTQ rights. And I think I need to explain that a little bit. So in the discussion going back and forth, you try to find language that everybody can agree to. And there were some issues around LGBTQ from members of the Gulf States, from Iran, and Japan. I want to say, Japan shocked me with their comment, well, we don't have those people. And I thought that was more offensive than what the Africa group said. And what the Africa group said was, hey, we're not there yet. We need some time to get there. I need some time to work on, and this is the spokesperson who's speaking, I need some time to work on the other countries to get to that point. We already have some countries who are there. South Africa was already there. But we need some time. And the backlash from that comment that came from Canada, New Zealand, Australia, UK, United States, let's look at the similarities of all of those countries, it was disgusting. It was absolutely disgusting. And when the African group walked out, I got very emotional. Because this was people who looked like me walking out of a negotiation that they needed to be there in. They were instrumental in. And I was told I made the speech of my life. I can't remember anything that I said. Mm-hmm. And actually, the note takers, there are note takers at the UN, the note takers stopped taking notes to listen. And so they came to me afterwards and apologized because there wasn't a verbatim of what I said. I know that at the end of it, there was a standing ovation, the room was full of tears, and government came and said, okay, we get it, we understand. And it was a speech about colonialism and listening and understanding that we're all coming at this from different places, from different spaces, from different levels, and we needed to put ourselves in the shoes of others. And the first year of negotiations ended with that speech. So what happened after that? Recognizing that there needed to be that communication, I took the initiative and created a WhatsApp group. And there were only three members of that WhatsApp group, that initial WhatsApp group. The spokesperson for the Africa group and the spokesperson for the EU. Because it was some of the comments from the EU that were very patronizing, colonialistic, and frankly racist. What then happened was they started to talk to each other. And if I didn't see anything on the WhatsApp group for a few weeks, I would prompt and say, hey, do we have new language for this paragraph, this article, whatever. And that encouraged them to talk. It wasn't until the second year of the negotiations, last year, that I found out that that had never happened before. Groups had not spoken to each other. Yes, you have those little debates and discussions going on inside the committee, but in terms of meeting as a larger group to go back and forth about, LGBTQ issues may be a problem for us in this region. Can you make a suggestion as to how we can deal with it? Or dealing with the informal economy might be difficult in this region for this reason. Can you guys help? And that, in 2019, 100 years after the organization came into establishment, was the first time that was happening. So now, at the ILO, they actually meet as a large government group. This went much further than Convention 190. One of the things that I've been asked to talk a little bit about, too, is the changes within the UN system and how that impacts the ILO. Everybody's looking for money. And so you're finding that within the UN, they're going to private partners and developing public-private partnerships to get funding to do particular things. And one of the controversial issues was around the tobacco industry. And we found out that it was the tobacco industry that was funding the ILO Child Labor Project. Interesting, because the tobacco industry uses child labor. Mm-hmm. So they were like paying off the organization to allow them to continue to behave badly. And so we took it on. Workers took it on. And again, you want to see the different dynamics as to how that conversation went. So there were countries like Canada who were saying absolutely no funding from the tobacco industry, but they weren't taking into consideration that with no funding, the workers also would suffer. So you have to sort of look at a balance. And so yes, we ended up continuing that discussion with that WhatsApp group on tobacco. And what the EU spokesperson ended up saying to me was, you know, if we would just take the time to sit down and have that conversation, a lot of the back and forth that we've done over the last 100 years wouldn't have been necessary, because then we would have understood where people were coming from. So within that WhatsApp group and beyond, they were able to work out a deal on the tobacco industry, not taking any funding from the tobacco industry, but coming up with ways in which to help the workers that were in that industry and the communities that were impacted. I digress a little. Let me go back to my notes, which actually talked about until last June, the government had never met as a full group, only by region. So that communication definitely made a big difference. Government representatives can speak face-to-face, and by the time they come into the governing body, they know what the arguments are and where everybody stands. So it doesn't take up the time, and they have a better understanding of where each other are at. Some of my key reflections in terms of my own participation related mostly to communication. With so many representatives from different groups and nations from all across the political spectrum, and the often clashing perspectives and varying objectives between workers and employers, I've learned, particularly through my experience of C-190, the importance of having this space that brings us together. I've learned that how to make surprising alliances with employers and governments, and how we must often work hard together well into the night to understand perspectives and find compromises and solutions. So in order for anything to happen at the ILO, there has to be consensus. So if those conversations aren't happening, you will never find that consensus. The process of writing a statement, declaration, or standard is a grueling word-by-word, paragraph-by-paragraph effort to reach agreement on concepts, language, apostrophe, periods, and, but, everything. Fortunately, we had a good relationship with the chair, who was Canadian and actually really helped in the process of the negotiation. And the fact that when you get to the ILO and you have a half-decent relationship or a good relationship with your government, it's easier to have that conversation, so it's easier to kind of get things done. And we are in a space now where we can have that conversation, but it wasn't always the case. Workers also collaborated tensely under the leadership of the International Trade Union Confederation, and made sure that we're lobbying our government with a unified message and voice. So all the workers come to it with one voice and one message. The UN reform process is also having an impact on the work of the ILO, and many of us fear that this may weaken the unique tripartite structure and normative mandate of the organization. Already we see the impact on the ground with the UN Resident Coordinator Program, which has seen the UN roll all its local agencies into one coordinating body under the UN SDG structure. Again, the resident coordinators don't know what the ILO does, and there hasn't been any training today to get them up to speed with what the ILO does. So it's been very, very difficult. It's been a very difficult year or so since they've been in place, but hopefully things will get better as we move forward, because we are pushing to get some orientation and to try and also get somebody who is versed in ILO working with the resident coordinator to do the work that that has to happen. In order to protect and advance principles and mandate of the ILO, governments like Canada will need to affirm their support of a broader of the broader principles of multilateralism in general, and specifically of the ILO and its unique tripartite structure and normative mandate. Canada can do this by strengthening social dialogue at the federal and provincial level. And we have seen some progress at the annual tripartite meeting ahead of the conference where, with our urging, we are seeing more participation from provincial and territorial labor ministries and their representatives. And they're not just sitting there and saying nothing, they're actually participating. I participated in four of those meetings since I was appointed to the ILO. And I can tell you, the first meeting, there was one provincial territorial person in that room. The second meeting, we had a few more, but both the first and the second meeting, very little was said. They didn't say very much, they didn't participate very much. February 6th was the last meeting that I went to, which was specifically on Convention 190, held in New Brunswick, and there was just about every province in the room and territory in the room, and there was a conversation. They were asking questions. They were asking about what the ILO does. They were trying to get a better understanding, and that has come with from the urging of the workers and, to some extent, the employers. So as the world around us, the world of work continues to change, we need to stay vigilant that we continue to be the voice of workers internationally. Workers' representatives at the ILO are able to negotiate for decent work, safe working conditions, living wages, gender equality, and more rights that raise workers up. The ILO is essential for the protection of workers in an increasingly globalized world, and the worker representatives are essential to a function, to the proper functioning of the ILO. All of that being said, I would be there for 5 years in June, and we're still having debates and discussions about protecting workers and employers, for that matter, from reprisals when they reach home after being at an ILO meeting. Mm-hmm. Yes. So governments are protected. All the governments, folks that are there representing governments, are protected from reprisals. They don't have to worry about being arrested. They don't have to worry about, you know, sanctions. But the workers and employers still have to worry about it. It's been an ongoing debate, and we just can't get agreement from governments on this. We have people who come to the International Labour Conference to make presentations and go back home to their home country and get arrested because of the presentation that they made at an organization that's supposed to be protecting them. So when you're looking at the future of the organization, let's think about the fact that that is still happening. Again, looking at where the organization is, we have to realize the state that we're currently in. The rise of the right, the effects of what's happening in the United States with a leader who has a number, well, when he started this, was there on his own, but now has a number of people that are right there with him, Brazil, Philippines, you know, and they are making their voices heard at the ILO. We had a discussion on Indigenous rights, and Brazil put off. So the discussion was supposed to happen on a Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock, and the discussion didn't happen on Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock because Brazil said they weren't ready, they needed some time to prepare. Well, they've known that this was on the agenda for months. What they were really doing was waiting for their ambassador to get to Geneva, because she was out of the country, to come to the table and speak. Now, there are time limits on how long you can speak, but when you have a chair that doesn't enforce, it allows people to go on at length. So the ambassador for Brazil went on for 40 minutes. Usually speak for 3 minutes. 40 minutes. About all the great things that Brazil is doing around Indigenous communities and Indigenous people. And then, I mean, there were rebuts, of course. Everybody kind of pushed back. And then when all of the debates were finished and the vote was taken, and, well, there was no vote, there was an agreement, we all supported what was in this document, but we did not. they took a second run at it. And I think we used a point of order. I actually, because I was a spokesman, used a point of order to shut them up. Because they were just continuing to go on. And they really don't care. None of these countries that are doing, or I should say behaving badly, really, really care about the ILO. Because if they cared, they wouldn't be doing what they were doing there. So, I mean, we have to look at the effect of the right wing on what's happening at the ILO. We have to look at the effects of the UN reform and what it's doing to the structures. The UN is trying to pull everything to them, to their way of thinking, to their way of doing things, and we're saying, no, the ILO is a standalone organization, and what should be happening is you should be coming into the ILO's domain. So you should be being tripartite, you should be unionized, you should treat your staff properly, all of those things. So those are some of the discussions going on. There's also, and it's kind of interesting, and that's putting it nicely, we have a director general that is from the labor, from the ranks of labor. Guy Ryder was the former president of the International Trade Union Confederation. But there seems to be this push to appease employers of late. So when you read the documents that you get from the office, which is what the director general's office is called, there's no balance, right? It's all pushing towards what employers would want rather than what is good for workers. And remembering that this is an organization that was set up to deal with that imbalance and to focus on the rights of workers and how to make workers' lives better, right? And we've seen that deterioration of that relationship. So I think that we really need to be extra vigilant going forward when we're looking at what the ILO is doing, and I know that the workers group has a huge, huge mandate to ensure that the organization stays true to what it was meant to be, and we're continuously fighting against privatization, against corporate partnerships, as I already indicated. The tobacco industry, there was also a partnership with McDonald's, which, you know, the UN, it was a partnership with the UN proper, and they basically said to the ILO that you have to follow as well because you're a part of the UN structures. The ILO did not. So again, they've got a number of people that continuously push back. So there are a lot of things that are good about the organization. I think it's still a necessary organization going into its second centenary. Very, very necessary. But we are facing an uphill battle. As I said, the employers, they're organized, they're doing what they need to do to push back. And interestingly enough, there has been a lot of discussion and a lot of support from employers, large employers. But the reality is, at the ILO, the group of employers that are sitting on the employer's bench are not those large, big box employers. They are small to medium enterprises, and they really, I don't even know if they understand their role, frankly, at the organization. There's still a lot of pushback. What I've seen is a lot of disrespect being shown, not just to the workers' bench, but also to the director general. And there doesn't seem to be any willingness of any of the folks on the employer's bench to say to their people, look, you need to be a little bit more respectful. You need to, you know, just pull back just a little bit. If I have 5 minutes, I don't know what the time is, but I want to encourage people to really take the time to read the convention. It's not long. It's a pretty short read, but it is an interesting read. There are some innovations in this new convention, and we don't call it the workplace anymore. It's called the world of work, because there really is no workplace, because everybody is, you're working on platforms, you're working when you're in the air, you're working on everywhere. So it was really important for us to get the language that is also part of this document. It's the first document that talks about the fact that we all have a right to a world of work free from violence and harassment. It deals with the gender-based violence. It has a gender component. It deals with intersectionality, which talks about how we all come to the table with different identities, and those different identities need to be looked at differently. The discrimination that's faced by those different identities needs to be addressed. And so there's a lot of things in here, as again, never been in there before. We did find a compromise to the language on LGBTQ rights, and it's there, and I think it's actually much better and much stronger than what was initially in the document, probably because it looks at what could emerge to be vulnerable groups. It doesn't just look at the current groups that are in situations of vulnerability. It looks at there's space there to say if tomorrow a new group of invulnerability pops up, they're also covered by this convention. And so I want to end by saying that there are a lot of things that the Canadian government doesn't do correctly, but with respect to the work at the ILO, they are doing really good work, with the exception of being part of the Lima group, where they walk out every time Venezuela opens their mouth. But again, that too we will try and work with and try and pull back. The Canadian Labour Congress is lobbying governments right now around ratification of Convention 189 on domestic work, Convention 190, the World of Work, violence and harassment in the world of work, and Convention 169 with respect to Indigenous people. And so there's a lot of work that we need to do, because we also need to educate our members as to why this is important and how they all overlap and fit together, because it does. The work of the ILO, as I said, is still very necessary, but we are facing the pushback. So part of our responsibility is the pushback of those who are saying, no, we don't need this organization anymore. And I will end it. Thank you.
Okay, this was the point at which we would turn it to the audience, but I don't regret at all that the panelists took a little more time, because it was really, really interesting. So I'll just make a one-minute comment and then flip it over to you. Also, first, people didn't disappear out of disinterest. I'm sorry they missed. I think there were students maybe in Catherine's class, so they probably had another class or something to go to. But it's, Leah started by talking about this SER-centric framework, how it can do little more than to manage the precarious. And I guess one question that comes out for me from these presentations is, like, how do we measure progress? What does it mean to say the ILO has been successful over the last 100 years? And, you know, is it really decent work for all, or decent work for more? Like, can we shift into the margins a little farther? Can we stretch the margins? Can we reach beyond it? And maybe we do that through some process of standard setting, but not just stopping at standard setting. The whole issue of enforcement is an incredibly important sister to that, because without it, they just sit there, right, unused and not tangible for the workers that it's intended to benefit. And then OB talked about, you know, the ILO not really addressing structural issues, whereas TWAIL sort of tackles that square on. And I wondered what role there might be for TWAIL to inform, or what synergies there are between TWAIL and ILO that they could learn from that. And then Marie gave a concrete example of how, you know, working using social dialogue towards establishing the important conventions that scoop up more of the precarious workers. And so there was kind of this flow, I think, between the three presentations. And I guess I wonder if, can we say that we've made progress because it's a bit better than before, a little bit like a bucket with a bunch of holes and water in it. You know, it's going to keep gushing out. But we plugged one or two or three, and is that okay? Is that something? And do we need to re-envision social dialogue? You gave an example of how in practice that folks use that to make tangible change. And speaking to Obi's point about structural issues, maybe that's one pressure point where you're focusing on the process of how things happen that could open the floodgates a little bit more for more holes to be plugged in that bucket. That's one thing that's on my mind from the presentations, but I'd like to open it up to other people in the audience who may have questions, keeping in mind that we're supposed to wrap up at 3:30. So if you could make your questions kind of like right to the point to get as much feedback and input as we can.
Thank you.